On the Empire Podcast this week, we chuck a tangled web over Zachary Levi and slow him down long enough to talk about Shazam.
I can't wait till the movie actually comes out so we can talk about it. So we can talk about the who's and the ha-has and the mum.
All this and more on the only movie podcast that watched the Joker trailer and worried about the amount of bullying that clowns apparently suffer. Let's please give it up for clowns for a moment. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. Yes, I'm a substitute for your regularly planned Chris Hewitt. I'm afraid he's at the dentist. So, instead, I'm joined by two other colleagues of such lethal cunning. Lethal cunning, kind of like the Joker, like a Batman villain. So, our very own rogues gallery today, we have Pilot Man, aka James Dyer, whose fiendish superpower is the ability to mention another podcast in every conversation he ever has.
Well, Helen, it's funny you should mention that, because on the Pilot TV podcast this week, we'll be dealing with the widow, the victim, and other things beginning with the.
Great, thanks,
also,
James.
Also, can I just point out, Chris is at the dentist.
Yes.
Having... let's be honest, Woot Canal, which, you see where I'm going with this?
Yeah.
There's a whole West Wing thing, like a parody we can roll into this. We get him in next week. He's had Woot Canal. He
Woot
can't
Canal.
Do it properly.
Yes.
But you are, in this case, you are the Josh Lyman of this
yes.
podcast.
So I will be revealing onto you just later today
yes.
the president's secret plan to fight inflation.
Amazing. Make
yeah.
it happen.
But of course, James, you're not the only one here today. We also have... a sidekick, I'll be honest, to James's Pilot Man.
That's fair.
He is online lad, Ben Travis. His ability is to publish a news story extremely quickly, like faster than a speeding bullet, but somehow like in a deadly way. I haven't quite figured it mm-hmm. out yet, but we can workshop
yeah,
it.
Yeah, they'll slice right through you. all the Twitters. I know him.
Which sidekick would you say you are?
I mean, probably Michael Cera Robin from the Lego Batman movie,
aww,
let's
aww.
Be honest.
As if you were ever anything but Penfold.
Oh.
What?
I don't know.
What does that mean?
I feel like he is kind of Robin-y, though. Look at that little face.
The perennial hope.
No.
I can't do acrobatics,
you are
though.
Actually like Lego Batman right now, James. It really is kind of working it out. He's going, I'm looking for a father figure, and you're like, nope.
Nope.
You are
not
wearing very dark grey, so...
I'm Batman.
Well, that actually brings me on to this week's question. Wow, segue. So this comes in from... at Remy's Gambit on Twitter, aka PJ Woolman. He asks, with Shazam released this week and Zachary Levi finally getting the movie he deserves, which other actors known primarily for TV would you like to see take center stage in a big damn franchise film?
I mean, the answer here is Idris Elba, isn't it?
Like, is it?
He's crossed over to film stuff, but it's never really worked out massively well for him. He's still best known for Luther, which, let's face it, the last two series were not good.
Ooh,
and I think
I can
like,
see James reacting there. Uh-oh.
He's such a talented guy and he's got so much charisma and he's so ready for some kind of big franchise that is not James Bond to kind of give him that kind of extra blockbuster clout, because he's like a blockbuster guy mm. who's never really had a proper blockbuster. Like Dark Tower kind of
oh no.
Yeah, less said about that the better. I feel like he's never quite made that. Like, maybe, you never know, Fast and Furious, Hobbs and Shaw, he's playing a villain called Brixton, a super-powered evil man fighting Jason Statham and The Rock, which just sounds like the greatest film ever made.
Ben.
So that could be it.
Penfold, shush. You know not of what you speak. Idris Elba was the star. His career peaked in the four-star masterpiece that is Molly's Game. I don't know what is wrong
oh,
with you.
Oh, good Lord.
How could he ever possibly top
well,
that?
Well, because, of course, James, that's not a franchise, thank goodness, because it's
oh,
only a three-star film.
Helen, so you say that now, but what happens when Molly's next game is released?
Molly's replay.
Yeah, Molly's rematch. It's going to be amazing.
Oh, it's going to be three stars again.
Yeah. I mean, he was Heimdall as well. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I guess.
He
but
was
then...
Master of the Bifrost, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, but he looked like he didn't want to be there the entire time. And he, in fact, said in interviews that he didn't want to be there, that he would rather go and be Nelson Mandela and never have to pretend to be Heimdall ever again. So I just think he is such like a headlining name, and he yeah. has not quite like found that role that's going to mm-hmm. give him that big.
What about Crawl in
franchise?
Star Trek Beyond?
I mean, who remembers Crawl in Star Trek Beyond? He was in makeup for the whole thing as well. He's another like actor of color who joins a massive sci-fi project and mm-hmm. then gets slathered in prosthetics and you can't really tell that it's them.
Mm.
So I feel like that doesn't really count
either.
Poor
one for Oscar Isaac in X-Men Apocalypse there
oh
as well.
Oh my god, yeah, poor Oscar Isaac.
I'm still upset about that.
Everyone's upset how about did they make Apocalypse.
It's like, how did anyone look at Oscar Isaac and go, how can we make him look not hot? And that is how much you have to do to him.
That is, I mean, that's a lot. It took a lot, but yeah. They did just about get there. It's depressing. James, how about you?
I would say, having not prepared for this question or really thought about it before this moment.
No.
Avery Brooks.
From
Benjamin Sisko himself.
Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
To be honest, I don't think I've seen since the finale of Deep Space Nine. What We Leave Behind. What We Leave Behind turned out was him. I'm sure he has been other things, but I don't recall seeing him in a while.
So what do you want him to do?
Anything.
What kind of thing? Just anything at all?
Anything that requires him to be bald and sporting a goatee.
That sounds like another Fast and Furious movie.
Yeah, absolutely. He should be the next Fast and Furious villain.
Or Goody. They could all be the villains. He can be the Goody. Oh,
love Sisko.
I mean, they
amazing.
Can introduce him as a Goody and or as a baddie and get him to do the worst thing possible and then turn him into a Goody in the next film.
Frankly, I'd take almost anyone from the cast of Deep Space Nine because we've not seen many of them since. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, where's Odo these days? Old Rene, where's he gone? What's he doing?
That's true.
You know,
and so many of them have aged super well.
Either Dax would be fine. Dr. Bashir's turned up in a few things.
Dr. Alexander Bashir's, Siddick,
yeah. He does.
Yeah, he was in Game of Thrones, so he's okay. Yeah,
well, exactly.
Well, yeah, he wasn't in Game of Thrones, obviously, but, you know, otherwise, he's okay. I'm sorry. Too soon?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think what we've said is the whole cast of Deep Space Nine should come together for a giant big screen franchise.
Okay.
Big Screen Nine.
Or just like a Deep Space Nine film after all these years.
Yeah, I'd take that.
The time has come. They're at an impasse with the Star Trek franchise right now. Why not do a Deep Space Nine film? What's stopping them?
Have you been watching Discovery, Helen?
I have been watching Discovery and I love it a lot.
A lot.
James, stop turning this into the Pilot TV podcast.
No, I can't because I've been banned. I've literally been banned from talking about Star Trek on this Pilot TV podcast, so I'm now just going to have to do it on here.
But it's so good.
I know. Thank you. You need to come on the Pilot TV podcast and replace, frankly, Terry and or Boyd, both of whom bully me whenever I talk about Picard or The Mandalorian or anything to do with Star Trek.
But, like, I mean, I'm hopeful for both those other shows. I'm not kind of sanguine about them yet. But, like, Discovery is here and we can see it and we know it's good.
Or
so.
Disco, as the cool kids call it.
I know, they do. And I want the running top with Disco in the front. But it upsets me that it doesn't then say Very on the back. I would like it to have both.
It should say Black Alert on the back is what it should say.
It should say Black Alert. We are so much better at this marketing
thing.
I
know. How cool are we?
Oh,
when's the Star Trek spin-off podcast coming?
I am unappreciated on my other podcast.
We should do a special.
We should. Oh, that's absolutely going
to
happen.
But to answer the question, which we were answering about 16 hours ago when we started this, I have an answer. I have half of an answer.
Give me your half.
I know the actors. It relates to something we discussed the other week, which is the imminent demise, RIP, of Supernatural. That gives you three super hot men who look franchise ready for any franchise you want.
I don't understand how I didn't see this coming. I don't understand how
all
like
the
were asteroid
there.
Flying towards the Earth with just dreading inevitability. I did not dread it, run from it. Supernatural and Arise, just the same.
I mean, it had to be. Come on.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely fair. I think, you know, that was it. Some destial big screen erotica is...
Oh, no.
What kind of exceptionally shirtless franchises are there that they could all kind of step
but they're
into?
They're never shirtless.
But they could be. Ooh. They could be now.
No, that's interesting.
Like Magic Mike 3.
Magic Mike XXXL?
Yeah.
Golly. No, I actually genuinely, I think it should, the criterion should be, we need a franchise that has a lot of plaid shirts in it. We want them to feel at home. What franchise has lots of plaid shirts? Some kind of lumberjack sort of a film. I'm not quite sure where I'm going with this.
Lumberjack cinematic universe.
Almost the kind of normcore wardrobe of the Bourne films. That's the kind of thing we should be going for here.
Normcore,
it's a thing. Catch up, James.
What is it?
Sort of fashionably unfashionable.
Like that's me.
Like what you see random dads wearing.
That's me. I'm fashionably unfashionable.
Like practical fleeces and
That's so a magazine I need to subscribe to.
Practical Fleeces magazine. Yeah, it's coming with the next issue of Empire, I think.
Amazing.
So they could start some kind of normcore heavy franchise.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there should be woods involved. I think there should be, you know, just like a bit hiking. I'm not quite sure what the plot is, but I feel like we can find something if we just give it a bit of some kind of Bigfoot, maybe. I don't know. Wait, this
Harry
is basically
and the Henderson's reboot.
This is kind of turning into Supernatural.
Or a
the
Wendigo.
Movie. That was episode 2.
It was. Do you know who was in that?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh.
Alden Ehrenreich was in it.
That's right.
Ooh,
yeah, Han Solo himself.
We asked him about it when we interviewed him for the pod.
Mm. Anyway, so that's my answer. And I feel like we've conclusively failed to answer that question entirely.
Although we have laid the scenes for the newest in our Empire pod universe, James and Helen's Disco Podcast.
Yes, it's going to be the best one.
It's going to happen.
I feel like I'd turn it for an episode expecting to talk about disco music, and then
you could be the tardigrade.
Sort of disappointed. Oh my god, I would love to be a party tardigrade. There's so many arms to do the Saturday Night Fever dance with.
Coming to you live from the mycelial network, it's the Disco Cast.
It's weird how big tardigrades have been in cinema recently.
They have. They are having a moment.
They really are.
Moment.
With Ant-Man, of course, and disco. Like, there's a lot of tardigrade action.
They have been there, minuscule, biding their time for so long, and finally getting the big screen representation they deserve.
Finally, it's paying off. Wow. And on that note, at Remy's Gambit, I hope that answered your question, and I'm so sorry if it didn't. If you'd like your question read out in the Empire Podcast, you can tweet us. We're at Empire Magazine and use the hashtag Empire Podcast. We're also on Facebook, where we are, again, Empire Magazine. It's a bit unoriginal. But we're also emailable, that's a word, at podcast@empireonline.com. All right. So while we're on the subject of kind of learning things and answering questions and talking about new stuff, quick mention here for two other great podcasts that are out this week. Our sister magazine Q has recently launched their own podcast, and this week they're going to be joined by Fat White Family, which I know sounds like the kind of thing I shouldn't say.
Stop being racist.
I know. I apologise.
And sizist. I mean, you're just a sickening bigot.
I am fat positive, but you know, hey.
A sickening bigot on this episode as well.
Yeah, they're an awesome indie band.
Anyway, Fat White Family are in fact, of course, a London-born post-punk band, James, as I'm sure you know well. Oh. And their third album, Surf's Up, is out this month. It's had great reviews so far. That's Surf with an E, so like it's a play on words. So I like them already.
Do we have any other podcasts, Helen, that you'd like to promote?
Well, here, James, I'm going to allow you to speak for no longer than 30 seconds.
I see what you did there.
On What's It in Pilot this month.
No, I would like to cede my time back to you, because clearly as a subscriber and regular listener to the Pilot TV podcast, you will have many, many wonderful things to say about it, and I would like to hear what you have to say. Honestly, between you and Chris, Ben, you listen to it all the time, don't you?
All the time. Every week, is it, that it comes
Ben's
out?
Just been fired. Producer Jane, do you listen to the Pilot TV podcast?
She's nodding.
She's nodding, but that was a disingenuous nod. Unbelievable. Okay, yes, on the Pilot TV podcast this week, we will be delving into the new Amazon Prime show, although it's ITV over here, called The Widow, starring Kate Beckinsale. We will be joining Kelly MacDonald and John Hannah for The Victim. Aidan Gillen drops by. We talked to him about Project Blue Book, which is very exciting. We also have a bit of a chat about Queer as Folk, which is 20 years old this year.
What?
Very, very exciting. I try and find an episode of Black Books funny. And
it's so funny.
I will not spoil for you what happens as a result of that. And we also do Toby Jones' new comedy, Don't Forget the Driver.
I love Toby Jones.
Yeah, I love Toby Jones as well. So there's lots of fun to be had on the Pilot TV podcast. Please subscribe to it immediately.
I think that sounds great, and I will listen to it.
She's lying.
But I will try.
You should.
All right, I think it's time for some news now. What's caught your attention this week? Anything big? Anything major?
There was a whole thing, wasn't there, Ben? In Vegas.
Yeah, there was.
Yeah,
the whole
CinemaCon
thing. Yes.
Where all the big studios have been showing footage of kind of major upcoming releases. Mm-hmm. We learned that the cats in Cats are going to be the size of actual cats.
Are we still pretending this film is getting made?
I don't understand. Isn't it like April 1st has passed? I thought for sure on the morning of April 1st they'd be like, kidding!
Wah, wah.
It's not a real film.
To be clear, they are cats the size of cats played by people in mocap outfits to make them look like cats, who will get post-production fur added to them to make them into cats.
Yes, giant sets. So that they are in proportion to the surroundings.
So they're proportionately the size of cats, but presumably they're still on two legs because they're not actually cats. They're like
anthropomorphic
like
cat extrapolations.
Like Puss in Boots style?
I guess. But even Puss in Boots had like a cat form. You know, he would kind of go down on four legs sometimes. I don't understand. I don't. Why? It has no story and it's stupid. And what is a Jellicle cat? Why am I supposed to care? I don't understand.
I feel we're not sufficiently cat positive on this podcast.
Okay, well, you go. Be cat positive.
Oh, no,
James.
I hate them. Absolutely. I'm never watching this film ever. You couldn't pay me to see it.
Hey, is that a bias against actual cats or about Cats the musical?
Oh, interesting question. I
firmly
believe that Cats are the vanguard of some kind of satanic invasion from the bowels of hell. That's, I mean, a side note to this, but this is, I mean, I've never seen Cats the musical.
Oh God, you're so lucky.
I've heard bad things.
Yeah, mostly that was me and Chris, though.
That's a good point. You know what? I might love it. Maybe this is the new Les Mis for me.
But, like, Les Mis has a plot a story.
And a revolution.
And a revolution, which was said in a slightly Hamilton way there.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it, James.
But a revolution.
Well, but, like, this has none of those things. Basically, this cat turns up at the beginning and goes, I'm going to send one cat to heaven. And then all these other cats turn up and introduce themselves. But instead of sort of going, hey, I'm a great cat, you send me to heaven, they all come along and they go, hey, I'm a big liar and a cheat.
Hang on. So the plot of this film is killing cats.
But is it? I mean, because nothing happens, because they just come along and introduce themselves.
What is it, like an existential quandary sort of posed by feline protagonists? That's essentially what this is.
But they don't actually deal with the quandary. Like, the quandary is placed there at the beginning and then ignored for the entire play.
What's the song that everyone likes?
Memory, which is going to be Jennifer Hudson singing that.
Yeah, so I like...
So that's going to be good. That's going to be like 5 worthy minutes.
I'm interested in hearing that. And the rest of it...
Okay.
We shall see. They didn't actually show any footage of this. I think they showed some, like, behind-the-scenes stuff so that people could see the oversized sets. But presumably they're going to spend the next year working on how these cats are actually going to look.
Not even a year, right? It's out in December.
Oh, my God. Well, that's 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Yowzers.
Wow. But, yeah, there was lots of other kind of bits. There was footage from Aladdin, footage from X-Men Dark Phoenix, and somebody from Fox kind of confirming that it's a farewell to the X-Men, as people probably have long thought it would be after the Fox and Disney merger. Disney have kind of confirmed their plans to make more Alien films, whether that's in the sort of Ridley Scott Prometheus verse or whether that's going the kind of Neil Blomkamp route and trying to sequelize Aliens or the kind of earlier films. We'll have to wait and see, but that's interesting, especially in the context of that Disney deal of where that's going to go.
Well, it's sort of, it's potentially good news for those who were worried about Disney completely shutting down anything over a PG-13 at the Fox end. That would imply, at least, because you hope they're not going to make PG-13 Alien movies, that they're going to keep up the sort of adult content that Fox was so good at.
Yeah, and I think even though all that talk about kind of, yeah, that this is the end of an era for the X-Men, they did confirm as well that the Deadpool movies are going to continue as they always have been. I think that's going to be a pretty good fit, the sort of meta nature of that character, just to shoehorn him into the MCU and crack a joke about it, will absolutely work. So, yeah, it feels like a bit of a sign that Disney aren't going to stop these sort of R-rated films being made. There was also Endgame footage, which I have not read a single thing about because I'm so in already.
Yeah.
But I just don't want to know more at this point.
Well, I'm with Ben on this. Like, I read that, like, people go, oh, there's some big spoilers in there. So I've now avoided it and all talk of it.
Wait, so does this mean we can't discuss it right now on the podcast?
Yeah, I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the trailer. I haven't read about the new footage.
Yeah.
But like, I just don't want to know.
Okay, but like, I kind of said to people, oh, I know Chris and I don't have time to do a spoiler special, but we'll definitely talk about it on the podcast. And you're now calling me a liar.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I feel a bit like, if we don't want to hear it, then surely our listeners don't want to hear it. They want to go in fresh. Because Helen, there is no time gem to turn back time so we can unknow these things that you would have us know. Well, we don't have it.
Well,
you know,
he gave
it to Thanos. I saw him do it.
Yeah, but you do it. It's on your desk.
That is actually true. I have an Infinity Gauntlet. All right, fine. So I could do that, but let's assume I won't.
I almost feel like asking you both to leave the room for a
you
minute.
You can just soliloquize about it.
I mean, I don't know what else to do. Okay, guys, sorry. I guess we're not going to discuss the Avengers spot.
Ben, we're going to get hate for this.
Like, you are going to get hate.
I don't care. As long as I don't know anything more than I know now going into the film, I'm
well,
good.
Well, I mean, there's a bit with a shaving mirror that is really upsetting.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
you
Helen.
See the immediate aftermath.
I'm sorry, Helen. I am sorry.
Not okay.
Well, you know what we can talk about, though?
What's that?
Joaquin Phoenix.
Let's talk about Joaquin
Phoenix.
Yeah,
so the first trailer for Todd Phillips' Joker movie came out, and it is not what I was expecting. I couldn't tell you what I was expecting, but it wasn't that.
it was sort of Taxi Driver versus the Joker.
It's really quirky and kind of hard to pin down. And I'm not entirely sure what it is, but I'm actually fascinated, which is a real step up from sort of crushing apathy, which is what I had beforehand. So this is good, as in this is very promising.
Yeah, it's looking like a sort of psychological drama, thriller,
yeah,
crime movie. I think one of the things that's getting a lot of people excited about this is that obviously beloved Christopher Nolan films, what they did was take the Batman story and plug them into kind of these really expansive crime movies, essentially, that happen to also be superhero films. And it looks like this is doing the same, but with those, yeah, gritty 70s style auteur driven cinema, bit of Scorsese in there. I have to say, the trailer looks kind of exactly what I was expecting from the early talk of what this film was going to be. And I think it's just a promising sign that Todd Phillips, having directed this and also co-written it, that they just, whatever it is, they have a really clear vision of what this film's going to be, and they've been allowed to just go and do it. And it looks stylish and dark and kind of weird, and yeah, I'm into it.
No, it's exactly what you say. I think the thing that comes through most for me on this is they are absolutely 100% certain of what they're doing. As you say, a really clear vision for what they want from this. And I think some fans may push back against that. It may not be what they're looking for, but either way, you know, there's a lot to unpack with this.
I'm really interested in it. I have a few reservations.
Go on.
First of all, as a trailer, I really liked it as a trailer. I think it's really exciting. Does a really good job. Has a great colour palette, actually. Looks amazing in terms of its, just the way it's shot, looks beautiful. I have a couple of major reservations. My first one is a perennial one to a Joker movie, which is that I don't think the Joker should have an origin.
I thought you were about to say, I don't think the Joker should have a red nose. I don't know why, but I swear to you, that's what I thought was coming. Because my main takeaway from the trailer was like, he shouldn't have a red nose. He shouldn't have a red nose. The Joker doesn't have a red nose. Why do you have a red nose?
Well, I mean, I hadn't even picked up on that, James, but I guess you do you. No, he shouldn't have an origin, and that's because in the comics, he has never had an origin that has been canon for any length of time. And I have read the ones you're going to throw at me, and I assure you they were not written as canon, okay? So I worry that when you put something like this on film, people assume that that is your Joker origin story rather than a Joker origin story, and I'm kind of not hugely down with that in principle.
I enjoyed the fact that Heath Ledger's Joker played with that quite
yes,
a lot in the film.
I really liked that. Yeah. It was one of my favourite things in Dark Knight. So I'm not 100% sold on that. And then there's a thread on Twitter by Hello Taylor, Hello_Taylor. That's Gavia Baker-Whitelaw, who writes for the Daily Dot, which I 100% co-sign. She was basically talking about the sort of the response to Batman films and the assumption from a lot of, she said, male film buffs, but it is mostly men, who see moral ambiguity and masculine angst as markers of serious cinema. And I feel like this is going to be one of those films that, like, a certain type of film fan who hates me is going to love. And therefore, that makes me wary of the film. And I know that's not fair on the film, but I just am exhausted with it. So, you know, I just feel like this is going to be this incredibly dark, serious, masculine take on the Joker that really offers me, I suspect, very little, but expect me to take it very seriously. And I'm not sure if I'll be able to do that. That said, as I said, it looks glorious. I really like Joaquin Phoenix. I mean, he just gave the most amazing performance in You Were Never Really Here. And I can't wait to see what he does next in that sense. But I just have worries.
Better this than Jared Leto coming back, that's all I'm saying.
Yes, that is true. So, sure.
I mean, the sort of people that you're talking about, I assume it's the people who watched the final season of Breaking Bad and were rooting for Heisenberg and hating on Skyler the entire way. It's that kind of, like, sympathetic to the male ego angst.
Yeah,
drama.
And just like they assume that anything that is dark is inherently better than anything that is optimistic, which I fundamentally object to as a worldview. I don't think that is true anyway, but I'm not going to judge the film on the basis of its fans, otherwise I would hate all Christopher Nolan films forever, and I don't. Or Fight Club. I would hate Fight Club, and I actually love Fight Club, so, you know, hey, what are you going to do?
Speaking of for the fans, there's a new cut of Apocalypse Now coming. Coppola's final cut of Apocalypse Now, as opposed to the Redux, and what's the other one, Ben?
The original and the
original theatrical, the Redux and the
was there a director's
workprint.
Cut?
Workprint.
So there's a few different cuts of this. Now, this is the final cut. We don't know what's in it, but I firmly suspect at the end we will have absolute concrete proof that Colonel Kurtz is a replicant.
Really?
Yeah.
This time, at last,
but
after all these years.
Always said that he wasn't.
It's going to happen.
Wow, that's a really nerdy joke.
This is coming to cinema soon, isn't it?
Well, it's coming to the Tribeca Film Festival, and part of it is this 40th anniversary of Apocalypse Now. So it's, as well as being this new cut, it's a 4K restoration, and there's no other kind of screenings confirmed yet, but obviously with it being the anniversary, and with Francis Ford Coppola having worked on this himself, it's going to get a wider release. Don't you worry. It's not just going to be in New York.
Just crossfading the last two stories slightly, the sort of 4K-ness and the Batman-ness. Did anyone see Warner Brothers released the pack shots for the new 4K editions of the Burton and Schumacher Batman films?
No.
Yes, they are not pretty looking.
Oh,
they
no, really?
Are not great. No. I mean, there's been a lot of, shall we say, Twitter backlash to this. My first Photoshop was bandied around quite a lot. I mean, I see what they were going for. They were
minimalist.
Going
for something bad and they achieved
they it. May have. I mean, the thing that bugs me the most is that there are multiple characters in each one, and on the cover of Batman and Robin there's no fucking Robin, but you know.
Oh,
are there nipples?
Helen's found them.
Yeah, well, they're not super great.
They're
are
not
they?
Super great, are they?
Wow.
I think it's just because we live in a time of like such amazing alternative art and fan art and amazing designers like Matt Ferguson and people who do these really kind of gorgeous alternate takes. And then you see that, and it's a chance when they do these reissues to bring some really amazing new art. And yeah, that's not it.
That's going on no student's bedroom wall.
No, Batman Returns is probably my favourite Batman film, and even I'm not tempted to buy that.
Let's face it, the poster going on all the new students' walls is going to be the Joker poster.
Yeah, that is probably true.
Yeah, but true.
I mean, we've gotten all this way because you wouldn't let me discuss Avengers. We've barely discussed Marvel at all, and that won't stand, obviously. So, quick shout out. Captain Marvel this week passed $1 billion at the worldwide
$1 billion
box office. Whoop, whoop. Which is a big screw you to all the people who decided to give it negative chat in advance. I guess it did okay anyway, guys. So sorry about that. What a shame. I guess you'll try again with the next one. And probably the next one that you'll be trying with will, of course, be Black Widow. And there was casting news today for that, rather tasty casting news in the shape of Rachel Weisz and David Harbour apparently in talks to join the film.
Yeah, the Hellboy crossover was unexpected, but welcome.
The Hellboy crossover is great. We also know that Florence Pugh will be in there.
Yes.
But we literally don't have any other details because, you know, Marvel hates details or information or admitting things.
That's a crazy good cast, though. Rachel Weisz off the back of another amazing performance in The Favourite. Mm-hmm. Just the prospect of her in a Marvel film is very exciting. And Florence Pugh just absolutely killing it at
Love
the moment.
Florence Pugh.
David Harbour seems like he's doing really well in the Hellboy film, like especially considering he's not Ron Perlman, which is a difficult thing to be when you're in a Hellboy film. From what we've seen of him in the trailers, I think he actually looks really good. Yeah, just like bring it on. I think even though the whole prospect of the Black Widow film feels a bit belated at this point, all of these extra additions to the cast just make it increasingly more exciting and something that I really want to see.
Yeah, definitely. So long may it continue. And of course, Kate Shortland directing that one, which is good news as well. There was also exciting news about an upcoming film, and that was Akira, which I feel like we've been talking about a live action version of Akira for approximately 20 years.
Definitely.
Yeah. I definitely wrote stories about it on the website way back in the day.
Yeah.
And it's never happened.
No.
And it still, like, might not happen.
Yeah.
But there's big people involved. Leonardo DiCaprio and Taika Waititi are working on it. And if there's anybody you want to be working on your Akira movie, surely Taika Waititi comes pretty high up the list.
Taika Waititi, a.k.a. the voice of IG-88 in The Mandalorian.
I mean, that's not how I would see him. I feel like most people might know him as, say, the director of Ragnarok and Hunt for the Wilder People.
Nonsense.
Korg even, but sure, you do you.
It's interesting timing, obviously, with Alita having done all right but not amazing at the box office, but also being one of the more well-received kind of manga and anime adaptations in that sort of live-action form, that maybe people are kind of still thinking of new ways that you can take these animation-based properties and actually deliver them in a satisfying way on the big screen. Talking of that, I rewatched Speed Racer the other week and it is flipping mental. It's absolutely nuts, but the good stuff in it is incredible, especially because the bad bits are so intentionally a choice that it's you lose all sense of, it's not like they tried to go for something that didn't work. They did exactly what they were trying to do with that
but
film.
Why would they try to do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll spend the rest of my life figuring that out.
But this, I mean, the hopeful stuff with this, so obviously I think anyone who is a fan of the anime film would be worried about an Akira remake. The good news is that Taika Waititi knows what he's doing, I think, and he has said some really important stuff, like you don't need to remake that film, you can go to the vast sum of books and do something from there. It doesn't have to be the same story. There was a bit of concern because that one of the reasons this came out was that the production's been granted, I think, $18.5 million in a tax incentive to film in California, which makes it sound like they're doing the sort of Americanized version of the story that people have always been a bit wary of. But again, Taika, who is no stranger to diverse representation in film, is talking about casting Asian American teenagers and getting that side of it right. So, you know, we've got to hope for the best, I think. I hope.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm with you. Let's hope for the best and maybe prepare for the worst.
In Taika we trust.
In Taika we trust. And on that note, we should probably wrap up the news
section.
Except
we can't.
We can't?
Because Groot is going to be in Avatar.
Yes, now I saw
presumably
this...
Presumably playing Home Tree.
Well, we saw this picture, right?
Yes.
Of Vin Diesel with
Yes, with James Cameron, saying that he'd always wanted to work with James Cameron and saying that he now was. So I can only assume that he is in an Avatar sequel. Now, obviously, I would love it if he was playing Mother Ewa. However, I don't imagine that is the case. Now, they finished the motion capture aspects of the sequel at this point, so they're looking at live action, which obviously leads us to believe that he will be playing one of the human, possibly antagonistic type of people.
Ooh, interesting.
I can really imagine Vin Diesel as a sort of big, gruff, growly military man in a James Cameron film. That seems like a really strong fit. And if, I mean, I guess all we know of the live action stuff from the first film was that it was military. So I wonder if they're continuing that thread. And if they are, he feels like a really good fit for that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've seen him in action in Saving Private Ryan, in a more sci-fi vein in the Riddick films. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems kind of natural. When will we see these films, James? Will they ever actually come out?
They will come.
Okay.
They will come.
And as much as a lot of people are still going, oh, I'm not interested in an Avatar sequel, believe me, when they start showing stuff and then when you revisit the first film and remember how much fun it is, people are going to be excited.
Are people going to be, as James Cameron so memorably put it, shitting themselves with their mouths wide open, though?
I will be, so feel free to come and join me. And
wow,
I'm going to be a communal experience.
Sadly, I'm going to be missing that particular screening. Of the smell.
Yeah.
Gross.
I'm Ben on this. I've got very little time for the Avatar backlash. When people go, Avatar was shit. Avatar was fan bloody tastic. It's really, really, really good. Please go back and rewatch it because it's fantastic.
Mm.
No time for haters.
I'm sorry, I'm in the same camp, so this is a boring agreement.
Yay, Avatar.
What an Avatar loving. Right.
I know. Wow. All right, so I think it's probably time to move on.
Hello, everyone. It's me, Chris Hewitt, just butting in temporarily to tell you that this week we are delighted to be sponsored once again by The Economist, the legendary magazine that's over 170 years old. That's a whole load of candles to blow out. To put that into some kind of perspective, Empire is only 30 years old this year, and I myself, I'm only a mere 25. Anyway, we have an incredible offer for Empire Podcast listeners, a free print issue of The Economist. It's an incredible offer. It'll unlock a veritable treasure trove and a Latin's cave of articles about economics, politics, entertainment, and much, much more. One article that caught my eye in the most recent edition, dated March 30th, fact fans, really nailed my obsession with the robot uprising that will ultimately see us all supplanted and lead to the birth of Skynet. You know, I figured they'd come for our weapons first, but I didn't think they would go for our coffee. But there's a really interesting, fun article about how robot baristas are becoming a thing. There's a coffee shop in Shanghai called Ratio, where a man named Gavin Pathros has invented a robot barista that can nail orders perfectly and produce 100 cups of coffee an hour with no mistakes. There's also an American chain called Coffee House that's on the rise. Now, this is all well and good, but it won't be too long, surely, before we're being forced to serve as baristas for grumpy robots in oil shops. How many shots of Castrol GTX with that one, sir? Anyway, if you want to get your hands on a free print copy of The Economist and stimulate your mind grapes with all kinds of great stuff, It couldn't be simpler. Just text the word MOVIES to the following number, 78070, and soon you will be expanding your mind. And in case you didn't catch that, that word again is MOVIES, MOVIES, and that number again, 78070. Say it with me, 78070. There we go. Thanks once again to The Economist for sponsoring the show. Don't forget to pick up your free print copy, courtesy of the Empire Podcast. No need to thank me. Okay, that's it for me. Sorry for the intrusion. Now it's back to Helen in the studio. And you know what? I bet she doesn't even say, thanks, Chris. Some people.
Okay, time now for a guest. Zachary Levi won the hearts of viewers as Chuck Bartowski, the inept super spy in Chuck. And he won over our ears as Flynn Rider in Tangled, the best Disney prince, really, apart from maybe Prince Eric, who retains a special place in my heart. Last year, he played a sarky doctor who was dating the marvellous Ms. Maisel. And now he's aiming to sort of have all our other bits fall in love with him as the star of Shazam. It's the story of a foster kid played by Asher Angel, who gains the power to turn into, basically, Zachary Levi, but with, like, superpowers. So we sent our very own Superman. Hang on, who wrote this? Okay, we sent Chris along to speak to him.
Oh, yeah. God.
I sound amazing. What about you, Zach?
I feel pretty good about it. I think we both sound very sexy. We have that.
I don't think I've ever sounded sexier, actually.
Yeah. No. You're channeling the sexiness right now.
Yeah, I pretty much am. Delighted to be joined on the Emperor Podcast by the star of Shazam, Zachary Levi. How are you, sir?
I'm doing really well, thank you. I am a little jet lagged.
Okay.
We just flew in yesterday morning, and that trip is always, no matter what, I can never get across the Atlantic without feeling like I've just been punched in the face and I'm on another planet.
Yep.
But I'm always happy to be able to come back to London, and particularly under such circumstances as this, to promote the biggest thing I've ever been a part of and such a fun, joy-filled movie where I get to play the big kid in me. You know, it's pretty groovy.
I've got to start, though, by saying you are having a meal at, it is 10:19 a.m., and you're having a meal.
Well, yeah, it's
you miss
like
breakfast?
It's
what's happening?
No, this is second breakfast, and then 11 Z's will be after this, and
get some Limbas bread in there.
Yeah, exactly. No, I genuinely have to kind of eat all day long, which for some people they're like, well, lucky,
yeah, where
you get
do
to
I
eat
sign
all
up?
Day long, but no, yeah, in this transformation that I've really kind of gone under, which has been incredible, and I'm so grateful for. Specifically of, you know, being in the gym 6 days a week and eating tons of calories in order to put on mass to fill this, you know, fill the shoes of this character of Shazam, and to try and maintain all of that. You know, hopefully the movie does well enough and we'll have some sequels or something like that. But in the event that that might actually happen, I want to be prepared. You know, I want to be ready to go. I wasn't going to let all of that hard work go to waste and then be like, oh, now I got to get back into shape. No. I'm going to keep this train rolling.
That's fascinating because I would have imagined, I mean, if it had been me, I have no willpower whatsoever, as you can see just by looking at me. But the second they called cut on the last day of filming, I'd have been just... Get me 10 burgers immediately.
Well, I did enjoy myself once I was finally able to, you know, loosen the reins a bit, if you will. And I still, you know, enjoy a cheat meal here and there, and, you know, certainly enjoyed my cheat tequila, which I probably cheat with too more often than not.
Do you pour that on the cheat meal?
Oh, I just pour the tequila all over the cheat meal. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just pizza covered in tequila. Oh my God, that sounds horrible and amazing. No. But truthfully, I having gone through all of this, I'm healthier and stronger than I've ever been. At 38 years old, you know, I am really grateful. I'm grateful for where I'm at in my life. I'm grateful for this film. I'm grateful for what it's meant to me already. With the movie hasn't even come out yet, and it's already paid such great dividends in my life. And so, yes, I'm very tempted to obviously want to consume mass amounts of carbohydrates because they're just heaven. but beyond that,
No, I don't really feel that temptation to be like, all right, finally I can stop doing this thing that's been so good for me. Like, it feels good for me, so I want to keep doing it.
You're always in good shape.
As we discussed.
When you shook my hand as I walked in, you nearly crushed it.
Okay, fantastic.
That's totally fine. Mission accomplished. Is that what you're aiming for with the handshake?
I'm just aiming that the person understand just how strong
the power
I am.
Dynamic.
Yeah, yeah, just know the power dynamic. It's when you pull the hand in, you know, like presidents of like heads of state and whatever, like if you're the one who gets your hand pulled to the other person, apparently you're in the weak seat. I don't know what that is, but it's a fine balance. There's, you know, I've crushed a few hands in my day, and then there's medical bills.
Of course, it's a whole thing. Do you have a person who tells you who you're shaking the hand of? Someone to whisper in your ear, Glenn. It's Chris from the Empire Podcast.
Yeah. Well, my publicist. I mean, yeah. Obviously.
You should have been immediately jumping in and going. Honestly,
like a fantastic publisher. She's just sitting in the corner now, saying absolutely, just smiling, nodding, and smiling. My publicist obviously helps with all of those types of introductions. But no, I mean, I try to be as present and informed as I can because I want to. You know, I think it's important to be here and now and respect the fact that we all have a place in this world and a job to do. And I just love that as an actor, I get to go keep popping in and meeting so many fascinating people. I mean, like as an actor, when you're successful and blessed enough to keep doing this stuff, you get to meet so many cool people and do so many cool things. So I try to be, you know, just as cognizant of that as possible.
Everyone's got a story.
That's right. Everybody does have a story.
Yeah. Everyone's got something you might use at some point down the line.
Yeah.
You never know.
You never know.
But the reason I was talking about your handshake and the fitness and everything is because, you know, the suit is amazing in this film.
Oh, thanks.
Couldn't you have cheated a little bit? I mean, you know.
Well, yes, I could have because I'm in the suit the whole time and it provides some augmentation and contouring and whatever. Fine. Yeah, sure. But it was honestly kind of more my own just personal conviction. Mm-hmm. I know that there were some fans out there, and probably still are some fans, of the Captain Marvel Shazam character and lineage, and the various iterations that we've seen brought to life in the various comics. You know, those fans see this, you know, massive dude mm-hmm. who is supposed to rival Superman, and when they see the guy who played the nerdy, you know, computer fix-it cat at a big box store for many years, they're like, well, wait a minute, you know, this doesn't seem right. And which is a bummer, because obviously it's like you're hoping that you get these roles based on your ability to play the character so much, more so than whatever the aesthetic is, which you can build, which you can change, which, you know, even Henry Cavill from before he got Superman to now has built into, character. Everyone does. And so I'm grateful that my bosses saw in me, they were like, oh, you've got the special sauce to bring this 14-year-old to life. I'm just a big man child, really. That's how that all worked. But and then they knew that I could go and put on that mask. I could go do that. So just on a personal level, even though I knew I was never going to have a shirtless scene, I wanted to know that I was putting the work in to honor the character, to honor the franchise, and honor, you know, and these fans who I understand that might have concern or whatever that is. It's like, okay, God, just know that I'm doing all the work that I can do. And I hope that's enough for them to feel seen and appreciated and know that, you know, we're all putting in the best effort that we can.
So how did this come about for you? How did you showcase your inner man child to...
Just basically showed up and was myself. That's what I did. No, I mean, I've always had a lot of optimism, or tried to, certainly. I've always been a lover of joy and purveyor of joy. I think that's why I became an entertainer. I really like bringing people joy. I like making people laugh and sometimes, you know, going really deep and dramatic and pointing, you know, shining a light on other stories. I was just tapping into really kind of my own enthusiasm. Mm. You know, Billy Batson, the Shazam as a superhero is very rare, I think, in all of comicdom because there are very few superheroes that are stoked to be superheroes, that are actually like really having a good time, where it's fun for them. Billy Batson's one of them. Peter Parker is another. then I start running out of examples. Everybody else is an adult and they're very serious and they take things very seriously. And I didn't have to do that. And so therefore I didn't have to rein in my own literal wish fulfillment enthusiasm of like, I get to be the superhero that I've always dreamt of being. Uh-huh. Like the kid in me that has always dreamt of being a superhero gets to now do this. The actor in me who always wanted to play a bona fide superhero is getting to do this. And all of that, I would hope, should make you feel pretty friggin' good and smile and the joy of that. And so I just tried to take all that and funnel it into the character. And then also, you know, look at my young co-stars who are so talented and awesome, but also, you know, very truly 14, 15, and look at them and go, okay, like, how do I absorb that energy? And then I was like, oh, that's right, they're kids. They have no responsibilities. that's how they end up able to be so silly all the time. So I just try to kind of, I don't know, drop some of that responsibility off my shoulders and lean into being silly. And yeah. I think all of that kind of helped, hopefully.
Yeah. Can you talk me through the progression of the kind of the process for you? And you go from audition, I presume you didn't turn up in the suits for the audition.
Yeah. What if I did? That'd be amazing. I had somebody building my own Shazam suit. They're like, wow, that's impressive. How much did that cost you?
Gentlemen, your search is over.
Yeah. No, well, the process was kind of interesting in that about 2 months prior to getting the job, I had been given an audition had been set up for me by my agency to go in to audition for the role of Shazam. And I knew at that point that The Rock, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, to clarify in case people were, and not to confuse with an actual Rock, not The Rock. So I knew it had already been announced that he was, you know, going to be Black Adam. And anyone who knows, I knew enough about the comics to know that Black Adam and Shazam are essentially doppelgangers. They just have different color schemes. Yeah. Because they have different stylists, apparently. And so I was like, well, wait a minute. Do you want me to audition for a character that is supposed to, in theory, potentially look identical to Dwayne The Rock Johnson? I was like, I have too much hair for that, guys. There's no way I'm going to be able to. No, it just didn't feel right. And so I thought I might be wasting everybody's time. And I was like, thanks, but no thanks. I'll let this one go. Then a couple months go by. I auditioned for an entirely other role in the film, a supporting role, mm-hmm. put myself on tape on my cell phone, sent that in. And David F. Sandberg, our director, and Peter Safran, our producer, and the folks at New Line and Warner Brothers all saw this and said, wait a minute, we think he could be our Shazam. Mm. I thought the role had already been cast by that point. And it hadn't. And so then I was very befuddled. I was like, excuse me, I might be right for this. And then through the next week, I mean, basically that was a Friday. And then the very next Friday, by that point, I had done all the camera testing and everything I needed to do to now be cast in the role of Shazam. And through that, I learned a tremendous amount more about the character and the lineage and also what they were looking for. Had I known, or perhaps maybe asked better questions 2 months prior, I would have known that they were looking for more of a Tom Hanks big, you know, an actor that can bring that to life in a most believable way. And and obviously the aesthetic is important, but we could work on that. And so once I felt that and clearly felt it very strongly because they gave me the job. Those idiots. I can't believe.
There's no going back now. It's done.
It is done. So that was kind of the whole process of the auditioning and finding myself in this role and continuing like daily, just counting my blessings and very, very grateful and honored. I mean, I know that sounds kind of lofty of a word, but I do think it's important to understand that you're given an honor when you are given a job like this. I mean, I think maybe any job is kind of an honor because somebody is seeing in you that you have a worth and an ability to do a thing, and they're trusting in that, and they're going to give you money to go and do that thing. So that's cool in and of itself. But the fact that these characters, you know, my character has been around since 1939. That's 80 years of people loving this character and some version of this character. Wow. And keeping it alive and buying the comics. And you know, I don't think you should ever take that lightly. I think you need to appreciate the fact that there have been plenty other people that have been invested in this character and in this world far longer than you. And to bring that to life as best you can and honor all of them, honor the role, and honor yourself in that. You know, I think it's a very heady, surreal, but super cool responsibility that I am grateful to have.
I'm doing a spoiler thing after this with David and Peter as well.
Oh, lovely.
But the character you auditioned for, we can't really say who it is, but it's, you know, at the...
And the hoo-hoo.
With the what's
in the
hoo-hoo? Yeah. Which is cool given that actor's connection with previous stuff going on.
Yeah. Dude, there were so many. I know, I can't wait till the movie actually comes out so we can talk about it. So we can talk about the hoo-hoos and the ha-has and the boom up. And I. Yeah, that'll be nice. It'll be nice for all of us to be able to talk about it. It'll also be nice for all of them to be able to talk about it. But yeah, the amount of strange. Coincidences and a history, not just for between me and others, but also just their journey within various.
Iterations.
Iterations.
Word iterations. Catch-all.
Yeah. So it's very, very cool. Very cool.
And you said this is clearly the biggest thing you've been involved with.
By far.
You also do have low an association with the MCU. You are one of the few actors to kind of straddle both worlds. Colossus. Jaimin Hansu is another one.
Yeah.
He's in two.
Jaimin Hansu did both Captain Marvels. I mean, that's pretty impressive. He's the connective tissue.
Oh my God, the Venn diagram is just Shazam, Captain Marvel.
Jaimin.
Which is really, really cool. But what your experience of the MCU, did that give you something to take into this, and what was that experience like? Because I guess ultimately playing Fandral, you were nearly in Thor, didn't quite work out. Then you were in Thor: The Dark World.
Yeah. So I mean, look, the broad strokes of it all is I am so grateful that Kevin Feige and Kenneth Branagh, because he directed the first one and cast me in the first one, though I was not able to do it because of my schedule on Chuck. Mm. That you know, when Kenneth Branagh says, I like you, and I'm going to... And doing a British accent, too. I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God, I'm really good. If Kenneth Branagh... So all of that was super cool, and I was so grateful that I got to even have that turn. And that, you know, Josh Dallas, who I think did a great job in the first one, but then his schedule got wrapped up with Once Upon a Time, the TV show he was doing, so then it came back to me, which was, like, really crazy. And then I was living here in London for 6 months when we were shooting Thor: The Dark World. Very cool. I would also say, and to answer the first part of the question, yes, I learned a lot from that. But I think we learn a lot from everything. We have the potential to learn from every experience in our lives. So what I learned in that world was kind of like, that was the biggest movie set and production and everything that I had ever been a part of. And seeing all those moving pieces and, you know, massive action sequences and all that jazz, like it was really, really cool. And also... Chris Hemsworth was a great kind of example, you know, like I appreciated how he carried himself on set. I appreciated his humility. I appreciated the work that he put into the role. I seeing him doing a lot of the things that I ended up ultimately having to do during Shazam, which was, you know, working out on your lunch breaks and eating tons and tons and tons of calories. You know, all of that, and he continues to be. I think Chris is quite inspirational, particularly in the whole world of fitness and being healthy and strong. I really, really love how he's leaned into that and has owned that. So, I gathered from all that. But on a creative level, you know, Fandral the Dashing, though an awesome archetype, you know, swashbuckling, Douglas Fairbanks kind of Lothario, awesome, awesome role to be able to take on. We didn't really have that much to do. You know, the Warriors 3, I think, could have been a lot more fun had they leaned into it being like, oh, let's do a team movie even in the first one. In the second one, you know, but we were kind of more comic relief in the Kenneth Branagh film. And then in Thor, we got some cool stuff to do, but there wasn't that much to do. And then in Ragnarok, we were really just sacrificial lambs.
Hello, bye-bye.
Hello, hi and bye. So that was... interesting. But I look, in the moment I felt a little bummed because I felt like, oh, well, that was my chip. I played my superhero chip. Yeah. I got a spin at the wheel. I got on the board. Grateful that I got on the board. Wish it could have been a cooler, you know, little stint. But, you know, there's plenty of people that never make it into any of the universes. So I was still very, very grateful for that. But, you know, a little disappointed. And but had I known that that was all part of me ultimately, you know, if I had not died in the Marvel Universe, there's a good chance I'd still be potentially under contract when the audition for Shazam came around. And maybe they would have said, like, oh, you know, you can't go and be that guy because we still might need to use you as Fandral, like, oh my God, in an Avengers, or, you know, just becoming dust when Thanos, you know, snaps his face, which would have been totally my fate. It would have been, oh, we're going to hold on to you, and then we're going to fly you to Atlanta, and then you're just so you can disappear. And it's like, great, I'm glad we did that. So it all worked out. You know, I'm so stoked that I got to be a part of the Marvel world. I'm well chuffed that I am now reborn into, that I've now been reborn as my own hero, as my own leading titular character. It's super cool.
One last thing before I let you go, or before I go, one of us moves. I'm not entirely sure who.
Both of us. Let's both leave.
Let's both leave at the same time. Leave the microphones running and just silence. There's been a GIF going around on Twitter recently of a scene from, I believe, the Captain Marvel movie that came out in the 30s or 40s, the very first superhero movie of Captain Marvel just straight up murdering a dude, just grabbing him and throwing him off the building.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there any discussion about incorporating that into your version of the character? Like, just straight up murdering guys?
No. We didn't discuss that. Because it didn't need to be discussed, because it's just in the character. Just murderous rage. Yeah, so the black and white Captain Marvel, that was like kind of some serial. It was the first time it had ever been tackled in the... In fact, it was the first superhero to ever be in theaters, but wasn't a feature-length film. It was a serialized kind of, you know, they would play a lot of shorts before feature lengths and all that stuff. And yeah, you know, this was well before we had any of the cool special effects we have right now. So his flying was really just like probably him hitting some kind of a trampoline and then like jumping into the frame and then picking up these gangsters, you know, because late 30s, early 40s. So it was gangsters, you know, those are the bad guys of the day. And like, yeah, see, we're going to get you, see. And, you know, picking up these guys and throwing them off buildings.
Wise ass, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, you dirty rat. That was a clearly a very kind of different take on it because, and actually, you know, the character, Billy Batson and Captain Marvel, at that point, when Billy Batson said the word Shazam, he transformed into a version of Captain Marvel that was very much an adult. This version, this more modern version, where even though I transform into what looks like an adult, I still possess my 14-year-old self inside, much more like the movie Big.
Yeah.
That's something that they kind of played with and then have kind of leaned into over the years. And I'm really grateful that they did. Because I feel like, look, Captain Marvel originally was essentially just a Superman ripoff, and and Fawcett Comics got away with it for a while. Like, good on, they outsold Superman. It was incredible. Then DC was like, no, and they sued him, and they won, and then ultimately Fawcett went under, and DC bought all of that, you know, the kind of catalog from Fawcett. So then you had essentially Superman and his doppelganger in many ways in the same universe. Well, if that's like redundant, you have two characters that are way too similar. How do you make a fun, creative scene that's interesting and have it, because you need different characters to do that. So I'm really glad that they leaned into the childlikeness of the character, because that gives me way more to work with. And it's so much more fun and funny and all everything that comes from that.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's now 10:40, time for another meal.
Yeah, I think so.
Zachary Levi, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, man. Pleasure.
What a nice fellow. So we may as well start the reviews section with Shazam. So as I said, this is the superhero story of a foster kid who can turn into a Superman, the latest from DC films, and probably their funniest and lightest yet. So who wants to start me off on Shazam?
Shazam, it's really fun, which is something you couldn't say about DC films a little while ago. I feel like this is continuing a good streak, really, from Aquaman, which was obviously a whole lot of movie and all kinds of ridiculous, but it was enjoyable. And Shazam, Yeah, it's just a really fun couple of hours. I think it veers in tone quite a lot. It feels like a film in three quite distinct parts. You've got, I'd say, a relatively slow build-up. You get a decent amount of time.
Good build-up.
Yeah, really good build-up. It's got quite a moody atmosphere in the opening act. And then you get the middle act when Zachary Levi comes in, and it just turns into a full-on superhero comedy, which really, really made me laugh. Did you guys find it funny?
Yeah, me too.
I found it a bit funny. I liked the lightness of tone in the same way that I enjoyed Aquaman because it wasn't moody and it had a nice lightness of tone. This has an even lighter tone. It's deliberately comedic. And I think it works. I think, as you say, but it's an interesting division because it starts in a quite serious, almost quite profound in the way it sort of layers the, shall we say, antagonist's origin story. I thought that was really interesting. But it's the kind of big S kind of 80s caper bit in the middle before the, let's be honest, quite generic third act. That I really enjoyed. Like, I enjoyed him interacting with his foster brother. The only thing I would say is, Asher Angel, who plays Billy Batson, aka the junior version of this character, is kind of a slightly sullen, sort of moody child. And then when he becomes Shazam, he becomes Zachary Levi, who is the most effusive, full of beans, big child I've ever seen in my life. So there's a slight disconnect between the two versions of the character, and I thought it was quite interesting that the two of them didn't really interact while making this film. So I wonder whether those two could have blended slightly better. That said, Zachary Levi's energy, I think, is what makes this film work. Like, he is so much fun, and he's so effusive, and he's so excited just to be Shazam and have these powers that you can't help, I think, being swept up with that.
I mean, I really agree that there is a disconnect there. I've been wondering about this, if that was to an extent a bit of a choice, that Billy Batson is this kid who's had a really hard life. He's in the foster system, and he is kind of like rejecting everyone around him. And then when he gets to literally be somebody else with superpowers, it brings a joy to his life
that
he's never felt before. But yeah, that, like, maybe that there is an element of character to that as well. Zachary Levi, I mean, the central section of the film is Zachary Levi playing off against Jack Dylan Grazer, who was also in the most recent It film. He was, what's the name of the kid with the inhaler, with the sort of neurotic mum in It? I can't remember the name of the character.
I don't remember anyone's character name in it.
He was that character in It.
Yeah.
And when those two are playing off each other, they are so much fun, and it really pokes fun at the tropes. There's lots of bits of fun improvisation.
Yeah.
It does a lot with that setup of what if you were a teenager inside an adult's body and that adult was a superhero, and all the stuff of testing the powers, all the stuff you see in the trailer basically is that middle section.
So much fun. It's funny because this is a film that felt to me when I saw it quite risky, because A, it's called Shazam, he's got a great big glowing lightning bolt on his chest, you know, it doesn't fit in any way with the wider kind of sort of vibe of the DCEU, and that's fine, and that's right, and it isn't, and it's its own thing. And I think this for me feels like this, and Aquaman to a certain extent actually feel like the sort of the cutting point where they've said, like, we're rejecting this world we tried to create. We're creating now standalone, independent things with their own vibe, their own mythology, and all the better for it because they don't have the baggage.
To be honest, they'd kind of already started that with Wonder Woman, which had already moved away from all the stuff they'd established in Batman v Superman. But I agree completely. They've stopped worrying about how do we make this kind of dark universe overall, and how do we make each film work on its own merits.
Now it's standalone.
Leaning into the characters and the tone of each character individually, because that's what made the early Marvel films work. It wasn't in trying to kind of homogenize them. It was going, okay, so who is this character on the page? Let's just do that and not shy away from its comic bookiness. And Shazam does that. I think it's all the better for it.
For me, I thought it had a really nice kind of Goonies-like tone in all those scenes with them together in particular. And all the foster family is really beautifully drawn, even in a few scenes. I think they're really, really great young actors, and just beautiful writing there. My only slight reservation in terms of this as a family film is it's quite scary at times. There is a boardroom scene with the bad guy that is genuinely quite freaky, and certain aspects of the bad guy's personality are really unpleasant. And so I feel like they've kind of maybe limited their audience a little bit, you know, to a lower age range that could have been lower.
Because it skews young in tone, but then in subject matter, it's kind of inappropriate. It's slightly hard to pin down what their ideal audience would be.
I mean, I think they're going for the kind of Goonies feel, because the Goonies and some of those films, Gremlins and stuff, when you go back to them, are actually quite disturbing at times. So I think they're kind of, if you can handle those, you'll be fine with this. But do bear it in mind if you have young or nervous kids that you're planning to take along. Yeah.
I can confirm. I sat next to Helen in the screening for this, and you were like squirming at points. It made it even more fun, to be honest with you.
Oh, that's great. Oh, yeah.
I really liked, I think... I agree that that's probably an issue for people wanting to take their kids to this, and maybe you should go and see it on your own first and judge whether you want to take them. I think for older audiences, and for me, I love horror films, so I was really pleased to see that David F. Sandberg, the director of this, who his other kind of big studio films are Lights Out and Annabelle Creation, so he brings those horror instincts in the moments when he needs to,
yeah,
in a way that it, yeah, is quite genuinely scary. So I think if you like his previous films and if you like horror stuff, and yeah, you'll probably like those moments. You'll just wonder whether you should take kids to go and see them.
Yeah, but it's not a full-on horror, to be clear, but no, there are some disturbing moments.
No, I like this film a lot. I mean, we gave it 4 stars, which, if I'm honest, I think is maybe a touch generous. I'd probably have gone more for 3, mainly because I think when it's funny, it's a bit funny. It's not a lot funny. I think it's never quite as charming as I think it wants to be either, and I did feel that the third act, in particular Mark Strong, who is fantastic in all things, including this, I just think he didn't have an awful lot to work with. And I felt like it didn't really deliver quite what I needed for the conclusion.
I really like that thing that happens in the third act that I'm not going to discuss.
Yeah, see, I didn't love it as much as you loved
it. I think that's really good, and I really like that thing. And I think that's a good decision for a film like this to take. And I think it's really interesting for the future what that gives us to work with. So
like that thing that happens in the third act that Helen liked. Or you may not like it in the way that maybe I didn't like it. But we're not going to tell you, so you don't know.
Go and
see the film to find out.
Indeed. So 4 stars then for Shazam, which is a recommendation. Next up, this is a remake of a Stephen King adaptation, Pet Cemetery, which is the story of a mysterious burial ground which brings things back from the dead, only are they as they ever were? Perhaps not. James, tell me more.
So this is Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Widmeyer's remake of Pet Sematary, the most, let's be honest, upsetting of Stephen King's books.
Yeah.
The original film of this traumatised me as a kind of as a young'un, so I was very excited to go and see this. A lot's been made, I think, of this, that they've made a few, shall we say, I'm going to tiptoe around this a little bit, they've made a few key changes to the storyline. Mm. The basic fundamentals of this are the same, where a cat dies, and thanks to a little bit of mystical hokum in a cemetery, comes back to life as an undead cat, and then later on a child dies, and well, you can kind of see where this is going. Now, they've made some interesting changes, and I understand why they made them. I think partly to shake this up, and partly to, I guess, change the nature of the threat here. And it works to an extent. Like, a lot of the beats are the same. There's a big incident with a truck, which we're familiar with. There's an incident with a razor that we really shouldn't talk
really
about.
Really unpleasant.
Basically the stuff that I've been having nightmares about since I saw the first film. But the problem for me on this is it didn't hang together. It's better shot than the original film. It's better acted than the original film. But it just, the horror beats didn't sit quite right for me. I watched this with Chris. He enjoyed it, I think, a lot more than I did. He reviewed this. He gave it 3 stars. I think King diehards might take issue with the key plot twist, but also the where this film ends, because it ends on a slightly different note.
Yeah, the ending, yeah. I think you might be right. I don't think that about the plot twist, not only because Chris is a King diehard.
He is.
And
it's very true.
You know, didn't so much, you know, object to it. I have read the book and really liked, actually I like a lot of Stephen King. This isn't in my sort of top 5 Stephen King books, but it is really scary.
It is. And it's like a meditation on grief and madness, isn't
yeah.
it? And the extent to which the mind fractures.
And the acting is a big step up in this. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
is.
Jason Clarke alone is phenomenal, but he's got a good cast around him, John Lithgow as well.
Mm.
Yeah, without getting into any kind of spoiler territory, it also does feel like it's been cut up and put back together a little bit.
The plot doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, and there's a couple of flashbacky sort of, you know, memory scenes where we haven't seen the memory in the first place,
yes.
and it feels like that was in there and was then cut.
There's definitely motivational issues, I think, missing here, specifically in terms of John Lithgow's character, where you're not quite sure, for example, why he takes him to the scary magical burial ground. It's never really explained, but that's fine.
I mean, it moves really fast as a film. I think, if anything, it could do with like 5 or 10 extra minutes just to add a few more kind of character moments. For me, I'm going to say it wasn't scary enough. I wanted to be more scared. I love being scared in films. And considering the idea at the heart of this film is so utterly creepy and freaky and deeply upsetting, I didn't feel deeply upset by the film. In the way that something like Hereditary, where just the central idea of it is so horrendously upsetting.
Yeah.
I didn't feel that in the film. But it's a kind of a fun popcorn horror film in a way that I feel like it shouldn't quite be a fun popcorn film because it's about such a horrible thing.
I'm with you. Like, I wasn't scared enough or disturbed enough. Like, I thought this was going to be like weeks of trauma and therapy for me after this film. And I came out and I was like, meh. It had that almost like you've got a bunch of friends around, you're having fun, you know, watching a film together. Like, it's almost one of those enjoyable horror films, not one of those really affecting horror films. And maybe that's what they were going for. And if so, well done, you succeeded. Yeah. But I think the original film and certainly the book stays with you long after you finish it. And this doesn't.
Yeah, the book is terrifying. But 3 stars then for Pet Sematary, which is still a recommendation. So next up, we have an unusual Western, which is The Sisters Brothers. This is a weird one. It has all the beats of a normal Western, kind of. It is Joaquin Phoenix and John C. Reilly are bounty hunters, and they're sent on the trail of a missing person who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal. And they have various trials and tribulations along the way, and then some stuff happens that you just don't expect, and it turns into a completely different kind of film by the end. I don't want to say too much because I feel like it's one of those films where the less you know going in, the better. It's directed by Jacques Audiard. He wrote the screenplay as well with Thomas Bidigan, and it's both kind of a really, really typical Western, you know, with the horses and the inns and the dusty towns and the riding over wide open spaces. And then something completely different, like they go to San Francisco at one point and they experience the big city. John C. Reilly experiments with toothpaste, which is a whole new and exciting thing for him. There's a whole kind of scientific experiment angle towards the end of the film that becomes completely fascinating in a weird and disturbing way and involves Riz Ahmed. And it's kind of great and kind of strange.
Do you get comedy John C. Reilly or drama John C. Reilly? Because they're like sort of bickering kind of characters, aren't they? They're kind of like playing off each other. Is he playing in his comedy vein or is he in that more serious?
He's mostly serious John C. Reilly, and certainly at various times he's very sort of drama John C. Reilly, who, let's not forget, can make both Talladega and Boogie Nights. But there are definitely moments of comedy here. There are really beautiful little comic kind of riffs here, but that's not the overwhelming tone of the film. It's very much more serious than that, mostly, but not all.
How does Riz Ahmed fare? Does he get more to do than he did in Venom?
Yes, he does. Thankfully, this is kind of redemption for the Riz Ahmed scientist type. But it's a very eccentric film, and it's sort of, they're kind of charming, so you don't mind that you're not quite sure where they're going because you're quite enjoying hanging out with them, basically. So yeah, so we gave it 4 stars. It is weird and it's not quite like a normal Western, but equally it's just quite likeable and I can't quite put it any better than that.
Is it a great Western?
Oh, like the... No. James.
Sorry. Yeah. I'm really just here for the puns because I haven't seen the film.
So that is all the films that we here in the room have seen. Missing Link, which is the new film from Leica, is also out this week. I am dying to see this because I love them, but I haven't seen it yet. But that is the story of, as the name suggests, a sort of missing link in the human evolutionary cycle, turning up and going on an exciting journey across country. Also out this week is last year's Cannes Festival entry, Happy as Lazzaro. That's another sort of slightly unusual drama, this time from Italy, from Alice Rohrwacher, and that has gotten 4 stars as well, which is, again, a recommendation, so do check it out. And, of course, A Clockwork Orange is also getting a re-release this week, and if you haven't seen that, and if you are a Kubrick fan, it is obviously a masterpiece, and you should check it out. So that is it for this week's Empire podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when we'll hopefully be rejoined by Chris and certainly joined by Jessie Buckley, who's here to talk about her fantastic new film, Wild Rose. Until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from James.
Bye.
Goodbye from Ben.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to continue my lifelong quest to figure out what the fuck a Jellicle cat is. Jesus Christ. Bye-bye.